From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, The Last Rescue, as we talk about Navy SEALs. Fresh back from Toronto, where we had a major event. 700 people at the Queen Elizabeth Theater there had just a wonderful time. Got to tell you, friends, our Canadian neighbors, they are the best. All right, here's what's happening. The captain who jumped to safety while hundreds of people remained inside a sinking South Korean ferry has been sentenced to 36 years in jail, but he was acquitted of murder. More than 300 people died in that tragedy. Dr. Craig Spencer, who was diagnosed with Ebola in New York City last month after returning from treating patients in Guinea, is now free of that virus and will be released from the hospital on Tuesday. That's great news for him. But new rapid response tactics are needed to defeat Ebola virus in Liberia, they say. More than 6,600 people have been infected with that, but figures suggest the number of new infections seems to be falling. That's a good thing. At least 46 students have been killed by a suicide bomber at a school outside of an assembly in the northeastern area of Nigeria. A suicide bomber dressed as a student is believed to have caused that blast at the boys' school. Police think that militant group Boko Haram carried out that attack. President Barack Obama is urging the U.S. government to adopt tighter regulations on broadband service in an effort, he says, to preserve a free and open Internet. In a statement released Monday, Mr. Obama called on the FCC to enforce the principle of treating all Internet traffic the same way. Now, that's known as net neutrality. Now, you want to find out what that all means? Let's check in with the expert, Lauren Weinstein. Lauren, give us a little definition first on net neutrality.
Yeah, well, in the context of what we're talking about here, it's basically saying that all traffic on the Internet should be treated in a reasonably equal fashion without discrimination. And unfortunately, this has become a political football. And for various reasons, you know, some politicians who shall remain nameless now have kind of gotten on the wrong side of this issue because they've taken the point of view that really is good for Comcast and AT&T and Verizon and Time Warner and the big dominant ISPs, but is not good for ordinary Internet users like you and me, because net neutrality is to protect us from those guys throttling us on those networks. And let's face it, the Internet now has become the fundamental communication system for the world. I mean, everything we do now, very soon all our phone calls are going to be on the Internet too. So just like water, just like electricity, you have to have reasonable regulations, because if you let private companies that are your only on-ramp onto the Internet have complete control, which is really what they want, they say they can actually censor you. Verizon has been suing left and right, saying, hey, it's our network, we can do anything we want on it. That's not practical anymore. The Internet is more than Verizon or AT&T. It's all of us now.
So that's dangerous. If we don't have this neutrality, we're up a creek.
Yeah, we're completely up a creek, because, I mean, do you want your speech to be controlled by Verizon? I mean, how many people think about their ISP, their dominant ISP, the big guys, and say, boy, that's they're wonderful, they're so sweet. I mean, keep in mind that here in the U.S., we have amongst the slowest Internet service and the most expensive Internet service all over the world. Sometimes in third world countries, they've got better and cheaper Internet service than us. And the reason is that they have real competition over there. But the big guys here, the dominant ISPs here, have been paying off politicians for decades to stomp down on competition. So now they don't want net neutrality, because net neutrality enhances competition. So unless we manage to make this work, it's going to be a pretty dark time for the Internet.
Sure. As I just increased my speed in the cave in St. Louis, Lorne, and it cost up to another $100 a month.
What kind of crazy. What kind of speed are you getting now?
I think 43. Is that pretty good?
And there are parts of the world, if you go to the Far East, for example, where you can get a gigabit, right?
Wow.
1,000 up and down. We're not talking about 30 meg down and 2 up or something. A gigabit down and a gigabit up, about equivalent $40.
Wow. And that must be rocket fast.
Yeah, it is. And we could do that here, too, if we didn't let the old phone companies and the old cable companies push us around and buy off politicians. But that's what they've been doing, and they have twisted the argument to try to make it sound like net neutrality is a government takeover. This is a case where I want government regulation as opposed to phone company and cable company control.
Let's follow this story, Lauren, okay?
Thanks, George.
Lauren Weinstein, expert on the Internet. Okay, here's something for all you parents. Laundry pods. Now, those are those colorful little packets that can easily be tossed into the washing machine. Well, they're convenient, aren't they? But they're also dangerous for young children, sending one a day to the hospital. New research conducted by researchers at the Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, found that from 2012 through 2013, U.S. poison control centers received reports of 17,230 young children younger than 6 years of age swallowing, inhaling, or being exposed to chemicals in these laundry detergent pods. Nearly two-thirds of the cases involved 1 to 2 year olds, and a total of 769 young children had to be hospitalized. They said that's an average of one per day there. Regular pot smokers have shrunken brains, according to a study. I guess there's no need to elaborate. Just want you to know what the study says. A massive storm fueled by the remnants of Typhoon Nori has nothing to do with me or my family. Did nothing to do to damage in Alaska's sparsely populated Aleutian Islands, but forecasters are saying that its system will push a frigid blast of air into the mainland United States and said temperatures plunging early this week. It's already snowing in some parts of the United States. Low-level radiation from Japan's Fukushima nuclear accident has been detected in multiple samples of ocean water off the Pacific coast of the United States and Canada. The sample nearest to shore was taken about 100 miles off the coast of Eureka. That's up there in Northern California. Now, this is what they do say. The levels are far below those that might pose a risk to human health or marine life. I hope they're right. Now, when a fellow by the name of Tyler Allen agreed to fork over $3 million in cash for a luxury condominium near Kansas, he wasn't attracted by the indoor swimming pool, the 17-seat movie theater, or the vegetable garden. The selling point for him of the 1,800-square-foot apartment? It will be buried 174 feet underground in a decommissioned missile silo, sturdy enough to withstand a nuclear attack. And a lot of people with a lot of money out there, the affluent, who are worried about doomsday snapping up these bunkers. Chris Geo is a radio host, entrepreneur from Dallas, Texas. His field of interest includes economics, geopolitics, occult agendas as well. He's also a survivalist, and he works closely with one of our clients, my PatriotSupply.com. I want to bring him in for a moment here. Chris, people like this, are they that scared that they have to pay that kind of money to hide?
Well, it's not really a matter of being scared, George. What it is, it's a matter of being aware, because Obama's on everybody's radar right now, but it's important to watch Russia and China, because they're doing great with the BRICS alliance, but the Obama administration and the UN ultimately have painted Russia to be the big bad wolf, when really Russia's the only country whose leadership is making any sense right now. But Putin is saying over and over and over again, World War III is inevitable, and I think that's what everybody is aware of at this particular time. Now, you have to remember, too, on the home front here, we have Obama saying that he's going to grant executive amnesty to at least 5 million illegal immigrants before the Republicans take the House and the Senate next year. Along with that, they're disarming the Border Patrol. That's all just going to turn into a huge, huge, huge disaster. If you've taken a look at what happens on Black Friday, that's over plastic garbage. Imagine what happens when there's no food on the shelf.
Oh, that's right. Now, Chris, I remember back in my days in school where we used to have these bomb and fallout shelter drills, and we were scared as kids. You know, we'd get underneath the benches and tables and crouch down. Not that that was going to do anything to save us, but are we going back to that? Are we going to have those kinds of days where we have to panic all the time?
My motto is don't be scared. be prepared. And that's the way that I try to live my life, being prepared for pretty much anything. And I think people like Alex Jones and others would agree with me in regards to that, because we are dealing with a monster here that has several tentacles. I mean, think about the Ebola situation. Because of this infamous nurse, what was her name? Casey Hicks?
Yeah.
Casey Hickox. Yeah, we've actually proven that she's a trained CDC intelligence agent. But the states are going to be forced to let people in, even though they're infected with something that kills about half the people who get it. And, of course, that is Ebola. So not only do we have the threat of World War III, we have the threat of Ebola right at our door.
Chris, keep bringing us these incredible stories. The European Space Agency says it all looks good ahead of this week's historic bid to land on a comet. This is exciting. The Rosetta satellite will dispatch its piggybacked probe to the surface of the icy mountain known as 67P. That'll happen on Wednesday. Controllers report both the mothership and the descent robot so far in excellent shape. Story in the news at coasttocoastam.com. I don't know about this. You take a look at it. A photo from the Mars Opportunity rover has captured an image that looks like a figurine riding a vehicle of some kind. I kid you not. Photographed image is presented enhanced, but the general shape is undeniable. You can, well, you go take a look at what it looks like, but it looks like some little creature riding some kind of a vehicle. It's in the news at coasttocoastdave.com. You know, in a basement in Denver, Colorado, in the summer of 2001, a group of friends attempted to contact a dead French artist on a Ouija board as part of a research project about the Holy Grail. They were hoping to get help decoding a historic occult mystery pertaining to the royal bloodline of France. They had no idea they were about to open a portal. In a moment, we talk about clock shavings. Tracy Triman joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Looking forward to a couple hours here with Tracy Triman. Has been writing about alternative history and the occult for more than 15 years. She's the author of several nonfiction books, also the former editor of the Degevert's Revenge magazine, a journal of esoteric history that was published back in the 90s into the early 2000s. Now, in 2006, her website made huge news when it was banned by the Supreme Court of Pakistan on charges of blasphemy. She's also featured in the documentary film Bloodline, and one of her books was licensed by Sony for use in the film Angels and Demons. Tracy, back on Coast to Coast. Ian Punnett, our good buddy, interviewed you back about, what, 3-4 years ago?
Hi, George. Great to be on. Yeah, I've been on, actually, I think I counted 5 or 6 times.
Yeah, you've been around. What a great writer you are, Tracy.
Thank you. Yeah, I've always been interviewed by Ian Punnett, but it's really great to finally get to talk to you.
So, tell me a little bit about this group in Denver. What did they try to do?
Well, this was a group, basically me, my husband and roommate at the time, Brian, who was helping me publish this magazine you mentioned, Dagobert's Revenge magazine. And then there were some other people that we were doing research with for the magazine, which was about esoteric history, and for a book that we were working on. And basically, we were researching the same sort of material that ended up in the novel The Da Vinci Code, came out a few years after the events I'm talking about. And some of the listeners might recall also that that whole subject matter really got started back in the 80s with a nonfiction book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail. So we were researching this topic of specifically a secret society called the Priory of Zion, which was alleged to be basically the protectors of a royal bloodline that is alleged, according to the publications mm-hmm. by this group, Priory of Zion. They put out publications basically saying that they were connected to the royal bloodline of France, that the royal bloodline of France is somehow descended from Jesus, and that this also has tie-ins with the Knights Templar and the mystery of whatever the Holy Grail is, which is still something that's unsolved. So we were researching that subject and actually had a whole magazine all about that, and we decided to conjure up one of the characters from that that secret society, Priory of Zion. The, one of the most recent, that is from the 20th century, grand masters of the Priory of Zion was this French artist called Jean Cocteau. And he was alive up until 1963. So he was popular during the earlier part of the 20th century as an artist and a filmmaker and a poet. And he's supposedly one of the grand masters of the Priory of Zion. So, and during his life, he was known for having seances with some of his friends in Paris. Back then, they didn't have Ouija boards, but they called it table rapping.
It was similar, or worked the same way, though, same principle?
Yeah, very similar. Basically, you would go through the whole alphabet. You would read it off as you're talking to the spirit, the letter A, B, C, and you would wait to hear a knock on the table or on the wall from the spirit, and that would indicate which letter you're supposed to, you know, write down next. And you would go through this laborious process to try to determine what the spirit was saying. But that's what Cocteau and his friends used to do. Some of the people in that group included Victor Hugo and his wife, you know, the guy who wrote Les Miserables. So there were
right.
Anyway. So I just thought this is interesting that this guy Jean Cocteau had done this when he was alive, and I thought, well, maybe now that he's dead, maybe he'll speak to us. And it was really just sort of a whim. You know, my friend Brian and research partner had just moved in with me. He was unpacking his stuff, and we found a Ouija board there, and we just thought, well, let's use it tonight. And sure enough, it actually worked, and it was absolutely amazing. And that got us started, really, because he told us some things in relation to the questions we were asking. But he basically indicated we needed to talk to someone else. So we ended up conjuring some other people, and the adventure started there, I guess.
And Tracy, in your book, Clock Shavings, you do talk about the fact that this may have opened up a portal to hell. What happened?
Well, it's just that the character that we were next referred to, Cocteau kept saying basically that he couldn't answer our questions very fully. And he had a hard time speaking, hard time communicating. And he told us that what we really needed to do was talk to Cain. Cain from the Bible, the murderer, murdered his brother Abel. And the reason it wasn't really that surprising to us at the time that he would say that, because we had been doing some research on this bloodline I was mentioning that supposedly goes back to Jesus. And what we found is really that the mythos, the mythology and symbolism surrounding this bloodline really seems to indicate that it goes much further back to perhaps these ancient times that are depicted in the Bible as having happened before the flood. So it literally might go back to what's known as the Garden of Eden. We were
amazing.
Tracing the bloodline and the mythology surrounding it back to ancient Sumeria. As you probably know, the Sumerians had a king's list that goes back thousands of years before the flood, and some of the kings were alleged to have ruled for thousands of years themselves. They had very long lives. And they were the Sumerians described their kings as having come from the gods, that they were like demigods.
Yeah,
basically.
Extraterrestrials, maybe.
Yes, quite. I mean, you could definitely. I don't know what they were exactly, but the extraterrestrial is a good term because they're not of this realm, and yet they were able to breed with humans and create a bloodline. So you know, in the Bible, they talk about the sons of God coming down and breeding with women and creating this giant race that was destroyed by the flood mostly. And so, but our theory was basically that, you know, this is where this sacred bloodline comes from. That's known as the bloodline of the Holy Grail. It probably comes from these fallen angels. And according to the research we were doing, this figure of Cain, it seemed, was really a lot more than what it says in the Bible, that he actually matches up to some of the figures in history, not only in the Sumerian stories, but other cultures as well. Ancient cultures have a character who's one of the first kings, has a name similar to Cain. Sometimes it's Khan or Can, and
that's probably the same person.
I think it's the same person, and that's what Jean Cocteau was indicating, and said that he identified him with this symbol of the Black Sun, which is sort of an esoteric symbol. It shows up in alchemy. The Nazis were obsessed with it. But basically, Jean Cocteau was saying, Cain is the one you want to talk to, and Cain is the black son. And so eventually we just gave in because we couldn't get the answers we wanted from Cocteau. So we actually just one night, and it happened to be Halloween, actually.
Okay, hold on. Hold on to that right there, Tracy. We'll come back in a moment. Our guest for the first couple hours, Tracy Twyman, as we're talking about her latest work, Clock Shavings. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Tracy Twyman with us, her latest work, Clock Shavings. Tell me about that title, Tracy, then we'll get into this Halloween event of yours.
Sure, yeah. The title comes from a book about witchcraft that was written around 1920, 1921 by a anthropologist. Her name was Dr. Margaret Alice Murray. And she was writing about some Swedish witches, I think in the 1600s, when this happened. She was writing about their initiation rites, mm-hmm. basically. And she said, they were given, this is a quote now, they were given a little bag containing a few shavings of a clock to which a stone was tied. They threw this into the water, saying, as these shavings of the clock do never return to the clock from which they are taken, so may my soul never return to heaven. So basically, I chose that title because it indicates the idea of, endangering your soul, basically, by trafficking with spirits. And specifically, the god of the witches that book is named after is this goat god, which we refer to now as Baphomet, because that's the name that the Knights Templar used for it. But basically, it's the same figure, a man with a goat's head that they would, revere and pledge their loyalty to, and basically sell their souls to when they were being inducted into these witch covens. And so I'm not necessarily saying that that happened to me. I did make some deals with the spirits that I ended up talking
to. Well, is it good to make deals with spirits, Tracy?
I didn't sell my soul specifically, but I did make some deals that kind of, worried me a little bit afterwards upon reflection. But so, yeah, I'm dealing with sort of infernal subjects, definitely talking to spirits that are in the underworld. That's what happened with Cain. Cain literally was in the underworld. He described it to us. And that's why he calls himself the Black Sun. He said that he was trapped in a prison, that God had put him there. And this happened after the flood. And basically, he described himself as being in a death-like sleep in this underworld prison. And he even said he was inside of a prism, P-R-I-S-M, like a crystal. So he was inside some sort of stone. And he said that there was some kind of energy radiating through it. And that's what creates this effect, which in the underworld is known as the Black Sun, that the other creatures that are down there with him actually have to sort of use the Black Sun to navigate the underworld because it's so dark and gloomy under there. There's no actual light.
Did you tap into Hades?
Basically, yeah. And, again, that wasn't the intention. I didn't realize.
No, nobody wants to do that on purpose.
No, you know what, though? There are stories. There's warnings, basically, in the Grail romances. It sort of indicates that those who seek the Grail are on a dangerous path, that if, your heart isn't pure, it may taint you or even kill you to be on this path, because basically you're going straight to the root of the divine. And the problem there is you're going past the sort of human moral system, and you're going directly to the origins of supernatural power. And this is why I was saying that the Grail bloodline may contain in it both the blood of Jesus and the blood of these fallen angels. Basically, we're dealing with a mystery that is beyond good and evil. In fact, it's the source of good and evil, that what we think of as a good and evil really is defined by this sort of family war that happened long before the flood, even between the fallen angels and the loyal angels, mm-hmm. and their human descendants. So it wasn't my intention, basically, when I started.
Did this all happen around that Halloween event you were about to tell us?
Yeah, sure. Well, basically what happened is we conjured Cain. We opened up the session saying, Cain, are you there? He starts talking to us, and immediately we can tell the difference between Cain and Cocteau. Cocteau was a deceased human. Cain was something more than human when he was alive. So his spirit is so much stronger in the underworld now. And what I mean by we can tell the difference, the planchette, which is that device, that indicator that you use when you're doing a Ouija board, the thing that points to the letters, it started moving around just very swiftly and with a lot of power. And I told you that Jean Cocteau had a hard time communicating in complete sentences and in English, but Cain didn't have that problem. And he not only spoke English, he spoke Sumerian, and he just started telling us all sorts of things, including, strangely, he said that we were cursed, me and Brian, the guy I was with. He said that we were cursed by Baphomet. That
did you get that feeling?
Well, I guess the reason why we brought it up, it was after asking him all sorts of questions about the underworld. And then we just decided to ask him a personal question because we had noticed actually some problems in our lives having to do with money. And I even wondered if it was a curse of some sort.
Why would you ask him about your personal stuff, Tracy?
Because he's in a position to maybe know or have a different perspective than humans do. I mean, we could tell from talking to him just a little bit.
Did you believe?
Omniscience, but he has some kind of sight that we don't have. So I thought, well, maybe he'll be able to see these spiritual things that I'm not aware of.
I mean, did you trust him?
No, not necessarily. but and I can't, the lack of trust grew over time. You know, I talked to Cain for a long time. We eventually started talking to Baphomet even more. But, you know, we became friends with these characters in a way. It was just an exchange of information over and over again over a period of years, really. So we got to know each other, but, you know, yeah, there were times when they told us incorrect information.
To trick you?
Well, I guess. I mean, there were times when it seemed like they would have known better, and they gave us information that they knew was false.
See, that's
times when they told us stuff that it seems like maybe they didn't know.
That's kind of dangerous, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I suppose.
Like
but I mean,
live Ouija board, almost.
Excuse me?
It's like a live Ouija board.
Well, you know, the strange thing is, like, I never was afraid during this entire process. And I would have thought, you know, before I also started all this, I would have thought, gee, if I ever see a ghost, I'll be scared. But when this actually happened to me, I wasn't scared at all. And there were times when it manifested somewhat physically. When, like, the first time when we were doing talking to Jean Cocteau, the bottle that we were using as a planchette actually lifted off of the board a little bit. And then there were other times when you could tell they were in the room because of flickering candles and noises and things like that. But one time when I actually asked Baphomet, one of the characters we talked to later, when I asked him if we could see him, you know, he's a demon with a goat face. He told us, you know, are you sure you want to see us? Are you sure you want to see me? And I thought about it and then I thought, you know what? I don't think I could handle it. So I said, no. But, you know, in general, I wasn't afraid during this whole process until, I guess, maybe deep into it, I started to kind of question it.
That would be kind of creepy to see that. Now, on your cover of your book, Clock Shavings, I see the goat figure. This must be the entity you're talking about, but it seems to be on a woman's body.
Well, that's what Baphomet is. He's a hermaphroditic figure.
Ah, okay.
He's got both male and female
attributes,
organs,
as we say.
And he's both animal and human. Because this is what he is. Okay, you know, the figure of Baphomet has been around a while. The goat man figure can be traced back to actually, you can find images of it on the walls of the preceptories of the Knights Templar going back to the Crusades. So it's not unknown to history, but it was only after this occultist named Eliphas Levi published a book specifically about this subject and had the image of Baphomet in there, where he drew it, like you said, on the cover, you have the male and female human body with the goat head. the specific way he depicted it, that became, you know, that was coined as the image of Baphomet. And then later, we found it, you find it on tarot cards for the image of the devil. So Baphomet has really been married to the image of the devil, and we think of it sometimes as being the devil. And I'm not going to say that that's incorrect, but it's a very specific expression of the devil. So it's the alchemist of the devil. You know, it's the alchemist and the teacher. And he's connected really to Hermes, the god of communication and teaching and learning.
Are you still in communication with this entity, Baphomet?
Actually, yes. It wasn't that long ago. I did a live session on the Ouija board on Halloween, and we were able to talk to Baphomet then. We actually asked him if the gates of hell had been opened, and he said they have recently been opened. So that was
what was the specific event that might have opened up those gates?
Well, he said it happened in July, and we asked about it basically because there's an internet rumor going on specifically about that. It had to do with the fact that there's an iPhone app named Siri that apparently when you ask it what's going on this certain date in July 2014, it'll tell you the gates of hell have opened on that day.
Huh.
And, you know, it seems like it's some sort of glitch or accident or something. No one really knows why that's happening. But it started off with me just asking if that's true. And really, the only reason why I took it seriously is because of the events that have been happening in Iraq lately. I just had this feeling that maybe that was connected. So that's why we asked, and he said yes. Now, you know, I said that I've become friends with these guys in a way.
Oh,
but,
boy.
but it's like I don't trust them, especially now. And I'm not as casual about it as I was back then.
I mean, do they know that you don't trust them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, especially now. I mean, what happened before was we basically formed a relationship because they were giving me all sorts of leads about my research. I mean, I have like 11 books now, and so much of it really started off with ideas that were proposed to me by either Cain or Baphomet on the board. And it's not that I'm taking what they say verbatim and putting it in my books. It's just a springboard for ideas that I wouldn't have been able to think of on my own, connections I wouldn't have thought of. There have been things that nobody knew really about history that they told me about, and I was able to substantiate it and write books and articles about it. So I found it to be a very useful tool for my research. And for the longest time, no aspect of it scared me at all. But what did end up happening, we had a secret society at the time. And it started off just being the name that we would use for the organization that's publishing the magazine. So we called it Ordo Lapsus Exilis, which is a reference to one of the Grail stories. They called the Grail stone the Lapsus Exilis in the German version of the Grail stories. Well, so we named our group that, and it was really just a casual group of friends publishing a magazine.
How many people?
It started off probably about 7 or 8 people.
Okay, not a lot, not a huge group.
And then what happened was, you know, we formed this relationship with Cain and Baphomet. And Baphomet in particular encouraged us to go ahead and develop this secret society and open it up to the public and try to basically teach the secrets of Western occultism to whoever the new membership would be. And I would say that we were basically learning how to do ceremonial magic and the secrets of alchemy and things like that directly from Baphomet. And so, you know, we essentially allowed Baphomet to be the head of our order during that time, which was a natural thing if you think about it, because actually that's the role that this particular entity has played throughout history. He was the head of the Templars. I believe he's the head of the Freemasons, and that they're continuing that tradition. And then also Aleister Crowley's OTO, same thing. He in fact called himself Baphomet. That was his magical name for the Ordo Templi Orientis.
Trace, don't you think you are dabbling with something pretty dangerous?
Well, I suppose so. None of the, you know, I've heard so many horror stories about people who have talked to demons or used the Ouija board and had poltergeist activity or really horrible things happen in their lives, supposedly. Nothing like that really ever happened to me. It was just more like after a certain point, I got kind of tired of working with Baphomet, particularly trying to run this organization, Ordo Labs at Exilis. He just had way big plans for it. He had all this work he wanted me to do.
He was trying to take over.
And it was a lot of work, and I wasn't really personally benefiting from it at all. And I sort of realized, oh, I've got the relationship between human and demon wrong. Because traditionally, ceremonial magicians, if they do dabble with demons at all, you're supposed to use them as slaves. You basically use your authority as a human, as a descendant of Adam. And you put them under your service because they're the ones that are in the pit. They're the ones that are jailed. And we're the ones that are free. And we're the ones that are supposed to be in command. But I didn't realize that until, you know, I was already knee deep in this relationship. And basically, at that point, I dissolved Ordo Labs at Exilis. I didn't do the Ouija board for a couple of years. And I told Cain and Baphomet, you know, I don't like the way this has gone. I don't want to be worked like a slave. I don't want to do your projects. Mm-hmm. I want to do mine.
Were there times you wanted to pull out the Ouija board and use it?
You mean during those 2 years?
During those 2 years, yeah.
Yeah, actually. You know, my husband at the time, he was my main partner. And I think he just got kind of tired of it, too. He got tired of it before I did. And so that helped break me of the habit for a while that, you know, I couldn't bother him to do it with me anymore. But, you know, eventually I went back to it. And what was really amazing, I think, was that the conversation started up almost without a hitch, like as though we were continuing the conversations from a couple of years ago. And even more amazing, what I found is that I can have the same results even when my hands aren't on the board, even with people that don't know the history of the conversations at all.
How long did it take you, Tracy, to summon him up?
No time at all.
Just like that. Bang.
Yeah, just, hello, Baphomet, are you there? And he comes. And, yeah, you can tell right away that once the planchette starts moving, that you've tapped in. And at that point, it's like you're on a telephone, and you can just talk and talk. Usually until, I mean, I usually was able to talk until I got tired instead of the other way around. You know, they rarely would cut off a conversation in the middle. They were willing to talk as long as I wanted to. And it would be so tiring, too, actually, after a few hours of doing this. We had a really large Ouija board, too, that was custom-made according to the design of Baphomet.
You're and giving me the willies right now. You know that.
Now, you know, let me tell you about the board, okay, because Baphomet, after a couple of sessions with him, he kept doing this code where he would go through the alphabet. He would go from A to Z and B to Y, and he would invert the alphabet from the edges inward, basically. He kept doing that over and over again. And so, you know, we kept asking him, what does that mean? And finally, one morning I woke up. This was after a session with Baphomet. And I found my husband on the computer designing this Ouija board. It was so complicated. It was so different than one that you might see at the store.
Yeah.
And and he said, oh, I just woke up and I had this design in my head. And he, you know, he thought basically the spirit was directing him to do this. And what it was, he arranged the alphabet in this way, inverting it. And he put it like the letters in a circle. And then there were all sorts of other things on it, like all sorts of astrological things
so he basically made it.
We ended up printing it out at Kinko's, really big, and we ended up using it, and we found that actually Baphomet was able to communicate even easier using this.
Tracy, that'll be a new ad for Kinko's. We make Ouija boards. Hey, we'll be back with you in a moment. We're at the top of the hour right here on Coast to Coast AM.